Welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. On the 15th of August in 1977, the Voyager 1 spacecraft was launched. Whilst this was initially built for space exploration, the technologies developed for the space race accelerated innovation into semiconductors, computing, and other communications sectors. These are industries that we now value at more than several trillions, depending on which market caps you are looking at. Speaking of market caps, interestingly enough, SpaceX today is now worth around $1.57 trillion, only $200 billion less than its IPO price. I'm Jimmy Muyaha. This is the SAFM Market Update. Let's get you up to date. Coming up on the show today, we take a look at the latest loan provided by the World Bank to hopefully reform our industrial development initiatives and drive our infrastructure development goals. $1.5 billion is the quantum of that particular loan. We're going to be speaking to John Lewis, independent economist, around that and get a sense of what it is that that financing could potentially do for South Africa's infrastructure efforts. Then we have a conversation with the team at Don Valley Reputation Managers, taking a look at the US firm Cisco's decision to invest in South Africa and invest in our smart city initiatives. We speak to the founder and MD at Don Valley Reputation Managers, Soli Moyeng, around that and get his thoughts around that particular investment and what it means for the US-South Africa relationships. We also have a conversation taking a look at the medical aid landscape, the private medical aid landscape, and in particular, the ambulance side of that. The Competition Commission is currently dealing with an application that's been brought forward to them by the private ambulance sector around potentially overhauling that regulatory space and creating a more competitive environment. Then we have a conversation with the team at Nedbank Private Wealth around their private banking offering and how it is competitive in the market and what it is that they're looking to bring to the market for their existing customers and potentially new customers. And then we wrap up the show, as we do, with a personal finance conversation. We're going to be taking a look at wealth creation beyond the savings component with the team at Novari Wealth and Invest. They're going to take us through perhaps some of the interesting insights that can be unlocked around wealth creation in the times we find ourselves in.
The day's markets, understanding the moves and making smarter investment calls.
As always, that's where we kick off the show, with a sense of market movements throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by Director and Portfolio Manager at Rand Swiss, Gary Boyson, to take a look at market movements and see what we make of them. Gary, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. Strange start to the week. It is the last trading week of the month of July. There's a lot of data that is coming out this week. And looking at the equity markets, it looks as though they're still battling with the risk sentiments that primarily sit in the oil space, with those tensions in the Middle East re-escalating.
Yeah, so it's certainly a lot of concern around the Middle East at the moment. Oil was above $90 a barrel for most of the day, and that sent our equity markets negative. So all share index down just over 0.5%, and the selling was pretty broad-based. So we had every sub-index negative, resources leading the decline, down 1.08%. MTN also having a tough day, almost down 4%. The Rand remains, I suppose, weaker than it's been, but all things considered, probably pretty good at 16.50 to the US dollar. We've had a little bit of optimism creeping into the markets with the S&P 500 moving up, call it about 0.5%. And we're seeing some rebound in those semiconductor stocks that were punished last week. So we've got the NASDAQ up over 1% at the moment. And yeah, while we are very concerned around what's happening in the Middle East, I think there is the sense that there might actually be an off-ramp. And while we've had all sorts of news, Houthi rebels in Yemen, warning of a maritime embargo against Saudi Arabian ports in the Red Sea. So any oil that could have flowed through, not through the strait, but instead come out the Red Sea, kind of question marks being put around that. Got a U.S. toll that's mounting. We've got the whole scope of the conflict widening as well. You know, essentially flow through the straits, has all but evaporated. We've had reports of, ships on fire, and the ceasefire is definitely broken down, but there is still talking happening in the background. And I think that's what markets are trying to latch onto here. So we do have the Brent crude oil price just dipping below $90, currently trading $88 a barrel. So maybe a little glimmer of hope there, but certainly still a lot of concern around the inflationary impact of higher energy costs, thanks to this conflict.
Gary, that inflationary impact, how do we see that filtering through into things like interest rate decisions? We've seen the US has confirmed that they're going to be cautious but still focused on inflation as part of their target, regardless of the new Fed chair stepping in. Following the departure of Jerome Powell, we know that we've got our own MPC meeting taking place this week. The Monetary Policy Committee of the Central Bank will be debating whether or not we have a rate hike, a rate cut. And I want to get your thoughts around that and potentially how these inflationary factors that seem to now be no longer, I suppose, to quote former Fed Chair Jerome Powell, transitory. These are seemingly becoming more and more embedded by the day. How do markets start to process these factors, especially where it relates to things like interest rates?
Yeah, so I think we got a pleasant surprise on inflation prints last month. Big decline specifically in the U.S. Or disinflation at least, and it was surprising, and it was really because we saw the oil price pulling back as firmly as it had. But kind of with the escalation of the conflict now, we're seeing those estimates around interest rates changing dramatically. So if, I always like to look out to the December meeting to try and price how many more hikes do we have this year, and at the moment. We were looking at probably, I'd say, a week or week and a half ago, we were probably looking at about 22, 23% chance that there'd be no hike from the US. That's moved down to a 15% chance now. So certainly markets in the US are starting to think that there are going to be interest rate hikes. Still the base case, I mean, a 41% probability that it's going to be 25 basis points from the Fed. And I think Kevin Warsh, being a lot more hawkish than many people expected, coming in and putting the focus squarely on price stability, which is one of the two elements of the Fed's dual mandate, the other, of course, full employment. But the focus of the Fed at the moment, given the, I suppose, the volatility around energy prices specifically, is price stability. So I think it really depends on what happens with the energy complex. But at the moment, yeah, probably we're going to get one interest rate hike from the US. The South African Reserve Bank, of course, has already hiked by 25 basis points. And we've got to remember that we, at a repo rate of 7%, we have real positive yields in our economy. And I think, looking at it, historically, South Africa deserved to be assigned a significant risk premium because of the way that we managed our fiscus. But I think there's a good argument to be made that we are making the right steps as a country, and that risk premium should probably decrease slightly. That said, looking out to the MPC meeting this week, it's going to be very tough to call. So economists are split on whether we're going to get a hike or it's going to be no change. If we look at kind of market probabilities, it's around a 50% chance that we get a rate hike. So it's really kind of a flick a coin meeting this week, and there's almost no way the decision's going to be unanimous. Of course, the MPC has to maintain its credibility. We can see what's going on in the Middle East, and I think that is going to be in focus. And the SARB has to maintain credibility and target that goal of 3%. So, with obviously the imported inflation that we'll get from high energy prices, I think they've got to be cognizant of that. That said, we have already hiked. There's no indication, and I think this is another big concern from the Reserve Bank, is that inflation starts to become entrenched in our system, and we suffer through the second round effects, and that comes through in the labor market. So suddenly, everyone, salaries and wages, when you're going for your next round of negotiations, you don't buy into the idea that inflation in South Africa is going to be at 3%, and suddenly start demanding 7, 8% wage increases. If that happens, I think the Reserve Bank is going to have to show that it's going to be tough on inflation. At this stage, we've seen no indication that those second round effects are becoming entrenched. So I'm going against quite a few of the banks here, yeah. But I'm going to say my base case for Thursday is going to be a pause. I think it's going to be a wait and see approach, just because of how volatile the Middle Eastern conflict is, and how quickly it can change as well. But I think there's almost no question that the governor's going to adopt a very hawkish tone, and just kind of remind us that this is not an easy decision that he'll be making.
Gary, before I let you go, I want to take a look at US earnings season kicking off officially. We know that the banks have reported. We know that some of them will continue to report. Some of the big guns like Alphabet will be reporting this week. Anything in particular you're looking forward to?
Yeah, I think both Alphabet and Intel are going to be big ones. So we know that a lot of this rally has been driven by, you know, the CapEx spending, you know, specifically in AI. And I mean, if we look at aggregate earnings growth for the year, we're looking at around at least for the quarter, we're looking at around a 26% increase, which is pretty spectacular. And as we've seen with the likes of, you know, Samsung reporting, you know, great results doesn't necessarily mean great responses from stock prices. So, yeah, I mean, if we take the banks as an example, I mean, they have absolutely shot the lights out. They've beaten on top and bottom lines. You know, they've benefited massively from market volatility. They've also benefited incredibly from AI structuring and financing arrangements. And Morgan Stanley is probably the standout performer there. But JP Morgan, also the highest quarterly profit ever achieved by a U.S. bank. And that tells you something about the financial picture, specifically in the U.S. Now, I think it's going to come down to, you know, is the operational and the execution actually fulfilling? So when we look at Alphabet, we're going to definitely look at probably Google Cloud over advertising for a change. I mean, last quarter, we saw cloud growing 63% back on the back of enterprise AI services. But our CapEx spending is going to be important. I mean, the Alphabet looking to spend $180 to $190 billion in 2026. So just understanding that CapEx spend and kind of what the forward guidance is going to be, I think is also very important for markets. Are they going to continue to spend? And also because Alphabet is kind of almost vertically integrated, I think investors are going to look at this business model specifically and see if the end user funding can justify the size of the build out. So I think Alphabet is really the one to watch this week. But Intel also, I think, very important, a very different story from Intel. I mean, obviously, we've seen a massive increase in the demand for CPUs working alongside AI systems. But I think what investors are looking for there is just manufacturing credibility and probably that they can convert this demand for CPUs into sustainable margins. It's going to be operational. It's going to be, you know, what does production capacity look like? What do foundry losses look like? Are they making progress in the manufacturing in the manufacturing processes? So a lot to watch this week as that earnings season rolling on. Expectations are high, and we're going to need some pretty serious beats to make stocks keep going up.
Markets have a lot to focus on this week, especially as we wrap up the month of July. We'll see how they contend with all of the data points that are set to come out. For now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. Director and Portfolio Manager at Rand Swiss, Gary Boyson, joining us to take a look at markets.
With a complete view of your finances, Nedbank Private brings every aspect of your financial life together to create solutions tailored to your evolving needs. From private banking and lending to long-term financial planning and wealth management, Nedbank Private supports you at every stage of your financial journey. While others see only part of you, we see all of you. See money differently. Nedbank Private. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
Time. When you're a kid, it moves slower than a sloth trying to get through airport security. There is just so much of it. Skip forward a few years to your 20s. Time is still your friend. It says have some balance. Go party and have fun. Then your 30s hit. And time suddenly steps on the accelerator like it's trying to catch a traffic light before it goes red. 40s. Now time is moving faster than your 10-year-old on a sugar high. 50. You're desperately trying to save as much as you can, but time is moving so fast. And all you can think is, where did all the time go? That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time for some much-deserved you time. Now, isn't that a compelling enough reason to invest? Ellen Gray, long-term investing. Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, this is the lending arm of the World Bank Group, has approved a $1.5 billion loan to support South Africa's infrastructure initiatives. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with independent economist John Lewis. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of these developments. John, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. This is the fourth such financing from the World Bank as a standalone financing that's been afforded to South Africa in the last 4 years. What do you make of this?
Well, I think it's a signal that slowly the optimism towards South Africa is building. I think firstly, we must get it in context, Jimmy. It's not big amounts in the grander scheme of things. If South Africa's infrastructure or fixed investment budgets from government and state-owned enterprises are very low, they've been relatively low since the late 1970s, early 80s. And just to give you an idea of the numbers, general government last year, 184 billion rands worth of fixed capital formation, and public corporations or state-owned enterprise, 119 billion altogether, 303 billion in a year. So 25 billion is not a big number in the grander scheme of things, but nevertheless, it's the fourth loan now, so it starts adding up. And the benefit of these World Bank's loans is access to expertise for firstly of the World Bank, but then also lower interest rates than what we will generally get on government long bond issues.
John, have we utilized the first three loans effectively? I mean, as you mentioned, it might not be a good a grand number in the bigger scheme, but it does start to add up, and we can't keep going back for financing if we're not able to show signs that we're utilizing these finances accordingly.
Well, difficult for me to say whether we've used those specific parts of the finance effectively or not. But if we look at our overall management of state-owned enterprises, I think there has been dramatic improvement that we can say, and I think the World Bank states that in its media release on this loan. Go back a few years and load shedding was almost a daily occurrence across the country. Now it's quite rare. So that has improved radically. The management of the electricity sector, and obviously with the help of allowing private sector in independent power IPPs. So that's helped. So those reforms, I think the World Bank is quite optimistic about. And then, of course, we in the area of transport and logistics, the first harbour concession for private sector in Durban, private sector concessions for railways, and that's obviously something I think that has to happen. Is, you know, along with improved management efficiency in government, allowing private sector into the areas dominated by parastatals, because they bring investment with them too. So I think there have been significant improvements. We could go on to others as well. Lots to be done, though, and a lot of the infrastructure is aging. So we need higher or much bigger infrastructure budgets ultimately. But yes, I think there's been significant improvement in recent years.
John, can we take a look at the particular purpose for which this loan was advanced or extended, aimed at supporting the water and sanitation efforts or infrastructure that we need to be addressing? You touched on the fact that we do have a lot of ailing infrastructure that needs to be dealt with, looked at, maintained, serviced, and potentially even replaced. This loan has the potential to create approximately 600,000 jobs, according to some of the data that surrounds it. But from an infrastructure development perspective, water, sanitation, we know we've been battling with, not just as a city of Joburg, not just as Gauteng, but as South Africa.
Yes, that's the next big project. Yeah, it seems like this loan is sort of spread across water and sanitation, electricity and transport. There's a projection of an extra 600,000 jobs by 2032, but I don't think that's not meant to be just in the electricity, transport, and water sectors. I interpret that as for the greater economy as a whole. I don't think necessarily an ambitious number. I think it's more than doable. It's a 3.6% addition to the most recent estimated total employment numbers for the country. So I think it's more than doable. I would hope to see a lot more than that by then. But I think that is the next big focus. We know that water infrastructure is getting old, very old, and a lot of leakage, a lot of loss of water in the system. So much to be done there. I think this is the problem, Jimmy, is that, you know, the infrastructure is has been aging for a good number of decades. The last big infrastructure investments, as I say, back in the late 70s, early 80s, and before that. So we're living on very old infrastructure at the moment.
Certainly a lot that needs to be done to address South Africa's infrastructure challenges, especially if we are aiming to advance the goals of the country and make sure that we're able to have enough infrastructure for all of the people that reside in our country. We'll have to leave the conversation on that note. Independent economist John Lewis joining us to share his thoughts on the latest World Bank financing $1.5 billion to South Africa's infrastructure needs.
Did you know that South Africa has one of the highest crypto adoption rates in the world? Fact. With that comes massive innovation and new opportunities. Stablecoins are the new buzzword in the industry. These are crypto versions of the Rand, the Euro, and the US dollar. But what's coming is even more exciting. Being able to borrow against your crypto and buying tokenized real-world assets such as stocks, wine, football teams, and real estate. Join me, Kieran Ryan, on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast each week to stay on top of what's happening in the fascinating world of crypto.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The US tech giant known as Cisco has announced a partnership with South African community organization Jozi My Jozi, aimed at enhancing and advancing South Africa's smart city ambitions through a community program that is set to kick off. We're going to be taking a look at this and exploring this particular collaboration or this particular partnership in a bit more detail with the founder and managing director at Don Valley Reputation Managers, Soli Moyeng. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. And Dr. Moyeng, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Your initial thoughts on this particular announcement? I mean, it doesn't seem very much like something that sits in Cisco's wheelhouse as a business at first glance, but also we know that we have strained relations with the US at the moment. To see US companies continuing to invest and engage in the South African economy.
Yeah, hi Jimmy, thanks for the invitation, and hi to your listeners out there, or many listeners. Look, when a company like Cisco looks at South Africa and decides, after everything that we've gone through, that this is where they want to take a chance, it means that they've seen something that some of us don't see. They've seen some improvements. We know that we've struggled for a number of years to attract key, hopefully long-term investments that bring value to the to our shores. It's happening, and hopefully this will be seen by other similar companies in the technology, engineering, sector, and other sectors, as a matter of fact, and come here to create partnerships that will leave value behind. And when I say value, I mean, you know, smaller companies that will grow into bigger companies that will go into the continent, that will create skills locally. We know that our high unemployment rate remains very, very, very unsustainable.
Now, from an investment perspective, we certainly will take any and all investments that we are able to attract, because those are good for the South African economy. Soli, I want to take a look at perhaps where we draw the line here around diplomatic relations versus investments, because you made a very good point around the fact that South Africa's investment case has been growing. We have increasingly become more investable in the eyes of Moody's, right, in the eyes of the World Bank, in the eyes of every international market, and that stands alone. Aside from the diplomatic relationships we have with the US, at what point do we start to look at the business relationships for that and put aside the diplomatic aspects of it? Because I think about something like Starlink, that has a whole different set of ramifications around it.
Yeah, look, we've always said there were at least 600 plus American companies that are invested in South Africa. South Africa is, America is not a socialist communist party, a country where private business has to obtain government permission to invest. Because we're not under sanctions. If were that the case, that would probably be a bit of a problem. But I think American companies can come here wherever they see opportunities. They will grow. The diplomatic issues are diplomatic issues, and we know that they relate entirely or mostly on South Africa posture on Israel and Palestine, maybe on a bit to an extent on Russia. But I think opportunities, American companies that see opportunities in South Africa, that see that there's increasing levels of policy visibility or predictability, stability, they will come here. But it doesn't mean that all the work that we need to do to attract more companies has been done. We still have safety issues. We still have electricity issues are not entirely gone. I think that we need to create more skills, especially in the STEM sector, you know, especially technology, education, and mathematics and engineering. We need to create more opportunities for companies to see South Africa as a serious base into Africa. That position has been, we had always positioned ourselves like that, but I think there have been, you know, a takeover, if you want, or doubt, especially when countries like Rwanda came up and said, we are the places where, the place where South Africans or outsiders must start. Even Kenya has been forging a closer relationship with Trump. But I think we should focus on the basics. Being a dependable economy, we still are the most industrialized economy in Africa. We still have the infrastructure. We still offer better opportunities to get into the continent. I think we should just invest in those things a lot more and creating more predictability and show the world that we are moving from a place of doubt to a place of serious certainty in terms of economic policy predictability.
Solly, before I let you go, I want to take a look at the diplomatic side of these relations. Some would argue that we're potentially missing the point that the US could down the line want to use those more than 600 companies as leverage into perhaps a different diplomatic conversation with South Africa, which we have seen President Trump not afraid to bring up in conversation. How do we keep that balance from a business perspective? How do we keep attracting business, attracting foreign direct investment, not just in the US, but from global players, without needing to have every conversation spill over into a diplomatic one?
Yeah. Look, South Africa has a voice in Africa. We have a voice in the global South. We cannot not use that voice. We just have to be careful that we don't use it against our own interests. And we don't lend that voice to other countries to use them in their own battles that have nothing to do with us. I think we have to keep going the way we're going in terms of growing the economy, creating more certainty into the business. Trump is probably, by the look of things, he's going to be weakened when the midterm come and go. And I think that he will not have the same power today. In any case, even if he doesn't, he has two more years in office. I think the South Africa must plan beyond the 2 years of the Trump era. We have learned from this, but the 600 companies that come from America have not left the South African market because of Trump's posture against South Africa. They're investing in a lot of people. South Africans, of course, we got threatened on AGOA. But I see South Africa having an opportunity to reposition itself as a very strong partner that is inevitable, that is unavoidable for current and for future American companies and others, as you say, from other companies from elsewhere. We are very contested. The issue of global or geostrategic positioning of South Africa will never go away. We are the only country that are sitting in this part of the African continent. Nobody wants to bypass us. It doesn't mean that we have to be arrogant, but we have strengths that we have to use. We must not let ourselves to be short of the value that we really could carry as a country.
We really do carry value as a country, not just for the African continent, but for the global trade conversation that is becoming clearer and clearer as we continue to see investment still coming into the South African economy with all of the geopolitical challenges that confront the world. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Founder and Managing Director at Don Valley Reputation Managers, Solly Moyeng, joining us to take a look at the latest deal announced by Cisco, entering into partnership with Jozi My Jozi to hopefully advance the smart city efforts that South Africa has.
With a complete view of your finances, Nedbank Private brings every aspect of your financial life together to create solutions tailored to your evolving needs. From private banking and lending to long-term financial planning and wealth management, Nedbank Private supports you at every stage of your financial journey. While others see only part of you, we see all of you. See money differently. Nedbank Private. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The private healthcare space is going through some difficult times from an industry perspective, and part of those times have required that the private ambulance industry has approached the Competition Commission to allow it to negotiate tariffs and payment structures directly with medical aid schemes. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail and trying to make sense of the implications this could have. I'm joined on the line by the stakeholder and liaison manager at the South African Private Ambulance and Emergency Services Association, Glenn Preston, to take a look at this and see what to make of it. Glenn, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Give us an overview of your members and this particular case that was brought to the Competition Commission. What brought this about and how did we get to where we are today?
Hi, thank you so much for having us and really appreciate you bringing the light on this topic. SAPISA is a industry association. We're a voluntary membership organization. We're representing 58 ambulance services across South Africa. We've got representation in all 9 provinces and many of the sort of peri-urban and rural areas where, you know, the sort of larger national ambulance services are not represented. And this application's come about for a number of years. The industry has been significantly underfunded, and the industry is dominated by sort of 2 national ambulance services, and then there are a small number of administrators that operate in the medical aid space that look after the EMS component. And unfortunately, these administrators compete amongst themselves for pricing to get the work from the medical aid schemes as an administrator. And then the ambulance associate or the ambulance services are then expected to service their clients at a tariff that's prescribed to them by these administrators. And unfortunately, for decades, that remuneration system has been significantly underfunded. And unfortunately, with the cost drivers going into the industry, it's basically hit a crisis point where the sustainability is no longer possible, especially in maintaining the high standards and care that the patients deserve and ultimately are paying for.
Glenn, let's take a look at what it is that you're asking for from the Competition Commission here. What would the ability to negotiate tariffs with medical aids do for the industry and for the service providers within the industry? What change are you hoping happens here?
Essentially, what happens at the moment is certain of the administrators are operating ambulances in the private EMS space. So they essentially are operating as the referee and the player. So they've negotiated what is called a capitated fee agreement with the medical schemes, and they get paid, on a risk transfer basis. So they will be paid X amount per member of the medical aid, and then they will take over and look after the EMS component of the patient's care and transportation, and they do the administration on behalf of that. The tariffs that they then prescribe to the various ambulance services is, one, significantly lower than what they pay themselves, and two, the ambulance services are paid within, time frames and in a manner which is dictated by these administrators, which are not always based on the requirements of the Medical Schemes Act.
Glenn, you touched on the fact that some of these service providers operate as associations, but also as service providers looking to render the services that they benefit from as well. If we are to go down the rabbit hole of having these negotiations with medical aids, does that not open up the industry to further possible collusion? Is that not something that should be a concern? And if it is, how have you proposed to the Competition Commission that this be addressed broadly?
So essentially what happens at the moment is that there is no negotiation in terms of costings and also for the services that are provided. Unfortunately, one of the issues that we have is that the profession and the industry has moved forward in terms of qualifications and training, and the tariff model that's being utilized is significantly outdated and unfortunately doesn't actually fit into the way that the industry actually operates now or the profession operates. So part of the competition's request is that we would be able to enter into a negotiation phase to try and overhaul the tariff structures that are being utilized within the industry. And in doing so, this should actually make things more cost effective. both for the schemes and as well, which obviously would hopefully, you know, boil down to the members of those schemes as well. In terms of collusion and, you know, anti-competitive behavior, currently the issue that is happening is that, you know, the larger services are, like I said, competing with each other on price to become the administrators. And generally speaking, ambulances are utilized to, you know, bring patients through to their respective hospital groups or, you know, to their providers where ultimately their main sort of form of income would come from. The tariffs that are being billed to the medical aides are quite significant. And in a number of areas within the country, the private services that are actually treating and transporting those patients are the independent services like our members. And the tariffs that they are being paid is significantly below what is being charged to the schemes on behalf of the administrator ambulance service. So that from our members' perspective is we're looking for a sustainable tariff. Government has previously investigated, and in early 2000s, a company called Healthman did a study, and at that stage stated that the ambulance tariffs were about 50% underfunded. With the year-on-year increases that have been offered to the private services, has been significantly lower than what have been charged on the members of the medical aids in terms of their annual increases, and that's just compounded the problem of the underfunding. Our belief would be that in allowing a collaborative negotiation on behalf of our members would actually be able to offer the medical schemes a more competitive pricing structure, but also in creating a sustainable tariff on behalf of the ambulance services to be able to meet the standards and the requirements of it. So I actually believe it'll have the opposite effect than a collusion or a negative impact.
Well, there's no doubt that we have a shortage of ambulances in the country that are operational, and we would need to do everything that we can to potentially alleviate that burden on the healthcare system. We'll see how this particular investigation unfolds. The Competition Commission is currently looking into the matter and has got the case out for public comment. We'll keep an eye on this and see where it develops to. For now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. South African, a private ambulance and emergency services association stakeholder and liaison manager, Glenn Preston, joining us to take a look at their plea to have standardized tariffs within the medical industry aimed at allowing ambulance service providers to remain competitive.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
For private banking and wealth management, choose Nedbank Private. While some see part of you, we see all of you. Nedbank Private.
We are taking a look at the world of private banking and the wealth opportunities that come with those sorts of services. This is an area that has obviously grown over the last couple of years from a banking perspective, but more and more we are finding that South Africans have personalized needs and the banks are having to understand these needs if they are to better serve their customers. We're going to be exploring this in a bit more detail with the executive for Nedbank, a private, Alan Shannon. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Alan, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. We know that from a banking perspective, banks are often a critical part to a financial journey, whether it's from a financial planning perspective, whether it's from an investing perspective, from a property purchase perspective. Banks form an essential part of the finances and the financial journey of South Africans. And more we're seeing that South Africans are experiencing their finances in different ways. How is that informing your opportunities and your viewpoint as Nedbank Private?
Well, I mean, for years, and specifically as it relates to the private category within banking, private banking sat in one place and wealth management sat in another. And I think the assumption, one, that as people accumulated wealth, they would naturally move from one offering to the next. And I guess we're challenging that right now because we don't think that's necessarily the case. You know, we as individuals have many things occupying our lives at the same time. You know, business owners could be growing a company while investing offshore, while purchasing property, whilst planning for children's future. And that's a lot to contend with as an individual. And I think our business is around making sure that people don't have to endure the stress of that necessarily. They can, you know, experience their life not in financial status, so to speak, but by being surrounded by people within NetBank Private that essentially can help them make that string of interconnected decisions they need to make in order to sort of reach their own aspirations and make their way through life.
Alan, speaking of those interconnected decisions, a lot of the conversations that happen around banking at the moment from a client perspective require a nuanced approach, because clients come into the conversations thinking, I need more than one solution, or I need a tailored solution, a specific solution, and this is unique to me and is for my future and my family's future. What does that then do from a NetBank perspective in terms of how it is that you design your service offerings to these clients?
Well, that's where the real value of being associated with a private proposition within a bank like NetBank comes into its own. And so, you know, when in the private business, the ideal is that your relationship banker who looks after your relationship can essentially guide you through all of those decisions. Now, that specific individual may not be the subject matter expertise on all. They may very well be able to help you navigate your next property decision. But when it comes to you figuring out how you go about managing your wealth in such a way that it sustains you through your retirement, leaves a legacy behind, then you're going to need the services of a wealth manager. And so the role of the relationship banker is to bring those various disciplines together to make sure that you are not being left out at sea, to be able to make sure that you're coming to the right decisions with all those facets. That's when the real value of being part of a private business such as that within NetBank comes into its own.
Alan, can we take a look at that relationship aspect in a bit more detail? I know for one, personally, I value my relationships very much, whether it's across professional relationships, personal relationships, and I can imagine this is very much the consensus when it comes to South Africans, especially where it relates to issues of money. You want to have a relationship with somebody that you can trust. You want to have a relationship that will transcend a 12-month period and not be a transactional thing. How does relationship then fit into your ethos as NetBank Private, and how does that allow you to look after a client holistically?
So the relationship is, you know, the absolute cornerstone of the private relationship within a bank like NetBank. And I guess the challenge people may have had over the years is having relationships that do change. And of course, that does happen. But the idea of having a banking relationship is to try and create as much continuity in your engagements with the bank, as well as to build the trust and confidence that you have in the advice that's being provided to you as a bank as possible. And so, you know, that's essentially what we do. We associate every client with a dedicated relationship person with whom they can build that confidence, with whom they can build that trust, and with whom they can access all the various requirements that they need out of a banking institution.
Alan, before I let you go, I want to take a look at how NetBank Private then positions its solution to be competitive in a market where all of the banks, most of the big banks, have private banking offerings. How do you then start to look at things differently when it comes to your customers and what it is that you offer them?
So I think perhaps the biggest shift for us has been, you know, there's a growing overlap between private banking and private wealth. And historically, these were treated as distinct disciplines, yet from a client's perspective, that distinction is becoming increasingly irrelevant. So clients don't wake up in the morning wondering whether they need a private banking or wealth management solution. They think about growing a business, funding opportunities, protecting assets. They think about outcomes, not organizational structures. Where we have shifted towards is that we believe the future lies in recognizing wealth as a continuum rather than a category. And so the real opportunity is helping clients navigate that continuum with confidence, whether they're building wealth, growing it, protecting it, or preparing to transfer it to the next generation.
It isn't just about banking, it is about relationship building and about looking after clients in every aspect of their financial journey. The team at NetBank Private looking forward to assisting their clients and welcoming clients that need their banking services. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Executive for NetBank Private, Alan Shannon, joining us to take a look at their private banking offering and how it is that they're positioning that differently in the market.
For private banking and wealth management, choose NetBank Private. While some see part of you, we see all of you. NetBank Private. With a complete view of your finances, Nedbank Private brings every aspect of your financial life together to create solutions tailored to your evolving needs. From private banking and lending to long-term financial planning and wealth management, Nedbank Private supports you at every stage of your financial journey. While others see only part of you, we see all of you. See money differently. Nedbank Private. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It is personal finance time on a Monday. We're going to be taking a look at some wealth creation secrets beyond savings with the team at Novari. I'm joined on the line by Dr. Terence Mann to take a look at this and see what we make of it. Dr. Mann, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Where do we start to have conversations around the difference between wealth and savings? Where does the bridge kind of start?
Hi, Jimmy. Thank you for having me tonight. Hello to the listeners as well. That's a very good question. You know, I get it a lot in practice. Savings is obviously very important, and building wealth. And I find that so many people focus on building wealth, which is fine. That's obviously how we develop wealth. But these conversations should happen. The bridge is conversations with your family. We're talking about generational wealth tonight. And, you know, I find that, you know, as soon as possible, start to have these conversations, you know, what's going to happen with our family wealth? You know, if circumstances change, you know, someone passes away or someone gets seriously ill. And wealth is not necessarily only, you know, savings. Wealth can be a business. You know, in most cases, we work with entrepreneurs. This single point of wealth is this massive business that developed the whole life and worked the whole life for. So it's very important to bridge that and have these conversations as soon as possible.
Dr. Mann, you touched on a very important topic that it's not just about savings. We should be thinking about wealth in different shapes and forms. And in South Africa, we know there's no shortage of entrepreneurial activities and businesses being started here. Where do the conversations then break down? If we know that businesses have the opportunity to create wealth for families and for generations, why then do we have the breakdown that we do when it comes to things like wealth transfer conversations?
Let me give you an example. Imagine my father was a big businessman and he had a very specialized business, whatever it might be, an engineer or a medical doctor or whatever the case is. And he now passes the responsibilities towards me if circumstances change. He passes away or whatever circumstances change because I'm his son. I'm next in line, the next generation to inherit these assets. But who's to say I want that responsibility? Who's to say I want to continue with the family business? I might have something in totality different in mind for my own life, which is not part of the actual family business. So that's why it's so important to have these conversations around generational wealth. What is going to happen with this business? In this instance, say, for example, I didn't want to continue with the family business because I had something else in mind. Then it's best for my father to have, you know, serious conversations in terms of business continuity. You know, what's going to happen with the business? There's obviously employees in the business that rely on the business, that social responsibility part as well. And there's a lot of business continuity cases you can go into. But can you see where I'm going with this, to have this conversation first with my family, not just assume because I tick all the boxes. I tick all the estate planning boxes. I have a will in place. I have life cover in place. I have abundant savings. You know, money doesn't necessarily solve the problem. You know, this is a more conversational thing with my family to see, you know, are they ready and do they want to take on the responsibility? You know, I strongly believe, you know, a well-funded estate can fail.
Dr. Mann, it sounds like you're talking very much around intellectual wealth transfer, not just the physical currency transfers
yes.
that come through. If we are to kind of broaden that conversation and look deeper into that, how do we ensure that the right conversations are being had? Because as you said, for some family members, they might not want to be a part of the family business. They might have their own ambitions and things. How do we start to have the conversation so that we can understand the value that's been created, the value that might be lost, and basically where the implications could be of these decisions?
This starts obviously with the head of the firm or head of the family to have these difficult conversations. It's not necessarily a difficult conversation, but it's a question to put out there. But in practice, Jimmy, what really works is to get a proper advisor involved in this, a proper estate planner, you know, get coordinated advice, because most of these guys will have an auditor in place. There will be an auditor doing the books, accountant, and there will probably be a lawyer involved as well, doing all the legal work and contracts and wills, etc. But you have a proper estate planner involved in this as well as a coordinated point of contact to help, you know, with these conversations, because most often a well-qualified estate planner and well-experienced estate planner will be able to probe these conversations to pick up and say, yeah, I hear you on this, but did you ever think about this and this and this, the soft side? That's a practical way of doing this.
Dr. Munz, let's take a look at first-generational wealth, those that are looking to start wealth for future generations, those that might not have businesses, operations, and things to inherit, but that might say, I think my side income or my side hustle could be an avenue for me to explore in the long term. What are the building blocks of new wealth creation where wealth didn't previously exist?
Yeah, so savings is obviously the first step here. I mean, if you don't save and you don't have wealth, you can't really plan for wealth. But I get it a lot in practice, Jimmy, as well, where clients ask me, you know, when is the right time to start think about all these generational wealth stuff you talk about and all these building blocks you're talking about? Because, you know, obviously it's a structuring exercise. There might be stuff like trust involved and all this stuff. And people usually think I must be very successful before I can even think about that. And that's not the truth. You know, if you think your side hustle, you know, can pull you through and really develop into something big, the best time is to start yesterday. You know, start as soon as possible with that. It's not necessary. It doesn't have to be this massive, expensive exercise. But to start working with someone and someone that can understand your face and how it fits together is powerful over the long run.
Dr. Munz, what about making mistakes? Often we're told this is the blueprint. It has to be a perfect blueprint in order for it to be a successful one. But what about the role of being able to make mistakes, learn from those mistakes, and teach those learnings on to the family, to the next generation? How much of a role does that play in the mindset and the psychological aspects behind wealth creation?
Well, I think that is massive. You know, Jimmy, I think most of the mistakes when it comes to generational and family wealth is disputes, you know, where family members end up in dispute. They fight about certain elements. And I think that's so powerful to learn from these mistakes, how we handle certain situations. You know, you get it a lot when, especially the elderly generation, where they are sort of private on their affairs. They don't want you to go there and ask, you know, the difficult questions, the serious questions. And that's in itself is a form of a mistake, because that often results in some form of dispute. I've seen it before where it was a massive dispute. So to learn from those mistakes and pass it on to your next generation, that's powerful. It's such a powerful thing to do to stop these disputes going forward, you know, because most often when there's emotion involved and there's disputes, that erodes wealth very fast, faster than the market will ever do.
Dr. Munz, before I let you go, I want to take a look at the power of collaboration in wealth creation. We spoke about the family aspects of it. We've spoken about the savings aspects of it. But finding good partners to collaborate with, whether it's family members as those partners, whether it's external business partners, that could also be quite a differentiating factor between the successes and the failures, because you're allowed to then build off of each other's knowledge bases. And what does that then do for the exponential possibilities around this wealth creation?
Yeah, I believe there's two sets of partners. There's internal and external. Your internal partners will be exactly like you've mentioned. It can be family members. It can be business partners. That's the people involved in the day-to-day operations, you know, of a business or a family operation, right? And that's powerful in itself, you know, because like you mentioned, we can leverage each other. But also from an external point of view, your professional external advisors, that's also powerful when those guys can coordinate and work together. And I mean, like, really work together, when you can phone someone and ask them, you know, what's going on in that and that and that financial statements? Why is this like this? You know, that's also a powerful way of working together. And if you can align these two bridges, internal and external partners, that's powerful.
There is a lot that comes through in terms of secrets to unlocking wealth creation. Some of it doesn't necessarily rely in having inherited the wealth, but rather in approaching the thinking differently. And that's perhaps where the secret, or the biggest secret rather, could lie in all of this beyond the savings component. We'll have to leave this conversation on that note. Dr. Tian Smans, Managing Director at Novari Wealth and Invest, joining us to take a look at wealth creation as a journey and looking at that beyond just savings.
Did you know that South Africa has one of the highest crypto adoption rates in the world? Fact. With that comes massive innovation and new opportunities. Stablecoins are the new buzzword in the industry. These are crypto versions of the Rand, the Euro, and the US dollar. But what's coming is even more exciting. Being able to borrow against your crypto and buying tokenized real-world assets such as stocks, wine, football teams, and real estate. Join me, Kieran Ryan, on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast each week to stay on top of what's happening in the fascinating world of crypto.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
That's the update for today, folks. If you've missed any of the conversations, they will be made available as podcasts to catch up on, obviously. As we go into the rest of the week, we await that Monetary Policy Committee meeting that will be taking place this week, set to kick off tomorrow, and that all-important rates decision. Will bring you all of the latest in that regard as the week progresses. For now, it's coming up to 7 o'clock. Greg Coase is standing by with the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. From my side, good night.